This is the Breaker.News podcast for March 3rd, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the big deal feature, the day the SNC-Lavalin scandal hit the fan, February 27th, Jody Wilson-Raybould and her testimony, and the calls for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to resign. And the reporter's notebook, Dr. Sport, Greg Douglas, looks back at his 50-year career in sports on the West Coast. The Jack Diamond Personality of the Year for the 2019 Jewish Community Center of Greater Vancouver Sports Dinner. And The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to someone who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or should every government in Canada that does business with SNC-Lavalin put all the contracts on hold for the time being? After years of corruption headlines at home and abroad, SNC-Lavalin is finally a front-page top news story after allegations of political interference in the Prime Minister's office. The company even paid $30,000 to wine and dine Libyan dictator Gaddafi's son on a 2008 trip to Canada, including $10,000 for prostitutes in Vancouver. Was that necessary? Couldn't SNC-Lavalin rely on its good, honest work at a reasonable price for its clients? Or is the infrastructure industry that dirty? Either way, our government's eyes were wide shut and we need better. The billions of dollars that are spent on bridges, highways, and rapid transit cannot be allowed to be put at risk of waste and corruption. SNC-Lavalin wanted to avoid a trial and threatened the government with moving out of Canada and sacrificing jobs if it did not get its way. The company says it has turned over a new leaf and all the bad apples are gone. But are they really? What proof is there? That's why Canadians from coast to coast need a full investigation about every contract with SNC-Lavalin. Did we as taxpayers receive value for money? Were there any bribes and kickbacks paid? Let's get it right in Canada, because justice must come before jobs. Jobs come and go, but when we lose justice, we lose our democracy. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Los Angeles Times, Hannah Fry, Alejandra Reyes-Velarde, and Suhana Hussein reported a February to remember in L.A. It never even reached 70 degrees. For the first time since forecasters began recording data, at least 132 years, the mercury did not reach 70 degrees Fahrenheit, or 21 Celsius, in downtown Los Angeles for the entire month of February. The average high for the month was 61 degrees, significantly lower than the historical average of 68 for February. That makes it the eighth coldest February on record, said Ryan Cattell, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Oxnard. February 2019 was the coldest since the government began keeping track in 1937 in Vancouver. Vancouver recorded 22 nights below zero. It averaged 0.4 Celsius, which broke the 1989 record of 0.8 Celsius. The average February temperature, historically, is 4.9 degrees Celsius. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. In the Seattle Times, Jim Brunner reports, Governor Jay Inslee launches presidential campaign with optimism about halting climate change. Washington's governor launched his campaign March 1st for the 2020 Democratic nomination. Before 200 supporters at ANR solar panels in South Seattle, Inslee said that when I am president, not one nickel of taxpayer money will go to subsidize oil and gas. Inslee, 68, joins a throng of declared candidates for the Democratic nomination, including Senators Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Kamala Harris of California, and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Other big names, including Vice President Joe Biden and former Texas Rep. Beto O'Rourke may join soon. John Hickenlooper, who just wrapped up two terms as Colorado governor, is reportedly considering his own announcement as early as next week. The Republican National Committee mocked Inslee in an email to reporters. It said, Jay Inslee's chances of becoming president are exactly what he's polling at. Zero. His campaign will only force Democrats into embracing more extreme policies like a carbon tax, which would kill jobs, raise energy prices, and disproportionately hurt working-class Americans. And we reported on these headlines this week. Former Clark aide involved in SNC-Lavalin meddling broke BC's FOI law. Whitecaps President Leonard Uzzi accused of bungling harassment and bullying complaint. And as Whitecaps and Rugby Sevens return, BC Place steps up name sale pitch. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. February 27th, 2019. For 4 hours, Canadians were glued to their screens to watch Jody Wilson-Raybould speak her truth about how she became the ex-Attorney General of Canada. Justin Trudeau's star Liberal candidate in the new riding of Vancouver-Granville in 2015 was shuffled to Veterans Affairs in early January. Then, in February, Wilson-Raybould quit cabinet after the Globe and Mail revealed that she had faced political pressure to let SNC-Lavalin off the hook from corruption charges in Quebec. Wilson-Raybould had stood firm. She was not going to tolerate political interference. The rule of law must prevail. SNC-Lavalin wanted to plead guilty and pay a fine under a deferred prosecution agreement, instead of face criminal trial over $48 million in bribes paid to Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The company even spent $30,000 to entertain Gaddafi's son on a 2008 tour of Canada that included visits from prostitutes. Wilson-Raybould decided the court case should proceed and that no special favors for the Montreal Engineering and Construction Company. Wilson-Raybould's testimony to the Justice Committee was jaw-dropping. Here are some of the highlights.
For a period of approximately 4 months between September and December of 2018, I experienced a consistent and sustained effort by many people within the government to seek to politically interfere in the exercise of prosecutorial discretion in my role as the Attorney General of Canada in an inappropriate effort to secure a deferred prosecution agreement with SNC-Lavalin. These events involved 11 people, excluding myself and my political staff, from the Prime Minister's office, the Privy Council office, and the office of the Minister of Finance. This included in-person conversations, telephone calls, emails, and text messages. There were approximately 10 phone calls and 10 meetings specifically about SNC, and I and or my staff were a part of these meetings. Within these conversations, there were expressed statements regarding the necessity of interference in the SNC-Lavalin matter, the potential of consequences, and veiled threats if a DPA was not made available to SNC. These conversations culminated in December the 19th of 2018 with a conversation I had with the Clerk of the Privy Council, a conversation that I will provide some significant detail on. A few weeks later, on January the 7th, 2019, I was informed by the Prime Minister that I was being shuffled out of the role of Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada. For most of these conversations, I made contemporaneous notes, detailed notes, in addition to my clear memory, which I am relying on today, among other documentation. My goal in my testimony is to outline the details of these communications for the committee and indeed all Canadians. However, before doing that, let me make a couple of comments. First, I want to thank Canadians for their patience since the February 7th story, which broke in the Globe and Mail. Thank you as well, specifically to those who have reached out to me across the country. I appreciate the messages and I have read all of them. Secondly, on the role of the Attorney General. The Attorney General exercises prosecutorial discretion as provided for under the Director of Public Prosecutions Act. Generally, this authority is exercised by the Director of Public Prosecutions, but the Attorney General has authority to issue directives to the DPP on specific prosecutions or to take over prosecutions. It is well established that the Attorney General exercises prosecutorial discretion. She or he does so individually and independently. These are not cabinet decisions. I will say that it is appropriate for cabinet or colleagues to draw to the Attorney General's attention what they see as important policy considerations that are relevant to decisions about how a prosecution will proceed. What is not appropriate is pressing the Attorney General on matters that she or he cannot take into account, such as partisan political considerations. Continuing to urge the Attorney General to take her or his mind 4 months after the decision has been made, or suggesting that a collision with the Prime Minister on these matters should be avoided. September 17th. I have my one-on-one meeting with the Prime Minister that I requested a couple of weeks ago. When I walked in, the Clerk of the Privy Council was in attendance as well. While the meeting was not about the issue of SNC and DPAs, the Prime Minister raised the issue immediately. The Prime Minister asked me to help out, to find a solution here for SNC, citing that if there is no DPA, there would be many jobs lost and that SNC would move from Montreal. In response, I explained to him the law and what I have the ability to do and not do under the Director of Public Prosecutions Act around issuing directives or assuming conduct of prosecutions. I told him that I had done my due diligence and had made up my mind on SNC and that I was not going to interfere with the decision of the director. In response, the Prime Minister reiterated his concerns. I then explained how this came about and that I had received a Section 13 note from the DPP earlier in September and that I had considered the matter very closely. I further stated that I was very clear on my role as the Attorney General and that I am not prepared to issue a directive in this case, that it would not be appropriate. The Prime Minister again cited the potential loss of jobs and SNC moving. Then, to my surprise, the clerk started to make the case for the need for a DPA. He said, quote, "There is a board meeting on Thursday, September the 20th, with stockholders," end quote. Quote again, "They will likely be moving to London if this happens, and there is an election in Quebec soon," end quote. At that point, the Prime Minister jumped in, stressing that there is an election in Quebec, and that, quote, "I am an MP in Quebec, the member for Papineau," end quote. I was quite taken aback. My response, and I vividly remember this as well, was to ask the Prime Minister a direct question while looking him in the eye. I asked, quote, "Are you politically interfering with my role, my decision as the Attorney General? I would strongly advise against it," end quote. The Prime Minister said, "No, no, no, we just need to find a solution." The clerk then said that he spoke to my deputy and she said that I could speak to the director. I responded by saying, no, I would not. That would be inappropriate. I further explained to the clerk and the Prime Minister that I had had a conversation with my deputy about options and what my position was on the matter. As a result, I agreed to and undertook to the Prime Minister that I would have a conversation with my deputy and the clerk, but that these conversations would not change my mind. I also said that my staff and my officials are not authorized to speak to the PPSC. And then we finally discussed the issue that I had asked for the meeting in the first place. I left the meeting and immediately debriefed with my staff about what was said with respect to SNC and DPAs. On September 19th, I met with the clerk as I had undertaken to the Prime Minister. The meeting was one-on-one in my office. The clerk brought up job losses and that this is not about the Quebec election or the Prime Minister being a Montreal MP. He said that he has not seen the Section 13 note. The clerk said that he understands that SNC is going back and forth with the DPP and that they want more information. He said that, quote, "Iacobucci is not a shrinking violet," end quote. He referenced the September 20th date and that they don't have anything from the DPP. He said that the Prime Minister is very concerned about the confines of my role as Attorney General and the Director of Public Prosecutions. He reported that the Prime Minister is very aware of my role as the Attorney General of Canada. I told the clerk again that I instructed my deputy is not to get, that my deputy is not to get in touch with the director, and that given my review of the matter, I would not speak to her directly regarding the DPA, ADPA. I offered that if SNC were to send, I offered to the clerk, if that SNC were to send me a letter expressing their concerns, their public interest argument, it would be permissible and I would appropriately forward it directly to the Director of Public Prosecutions. Later that day, my Chief of Staff had a phone call with Elder Marquez and Mathieu Bouchard from the Prime Minister's office. They wanted an update on what was going on regarding the DPAs since, quote, we don't have a ton of time, end quote. She relayed my summary of the meeting with the clerk and the Prime Minister. Mathieu and Elder also raised the idea of a, quote, informal reach out, end quote, to the DPP. My Chief of Staff said that she knew I was not comfortable with that, as it looked like and probably did constitute political interference. They asked whether that was true, if it wasn't the Attorney General herself, but if it was her staff or the Deputy Minister. My Chief of Staff said yes, it would, and offered a call with me directly. They said that they will regroup and get back to you on that. Still on September the 19th, I spoke to Minister Morneau on this matter when we were in the House. He again stressed the need to save jobs, and I told him that engagements from his office to mine on SNC had to stop, that they were inappropriate. They did not stop. On September the 20th, my Chief of Staff had phone calls with Mr. Chin and Justin To, both members of the Minister of Finance's office, about DPAs and SNC.
Trudeau, however, disputed Wilson-Raybould's testimony and claimed the Liberal government's first priority is saving jobs. But will he be called to testify, or will the RCMP come in to investigate?
I strongly maintain, as I have from the beginning, that I and my staff always acted appropriately and professionally, and therefore I completely disagree with the characterization of the former Attorney General about these events.
Opposition Leader Andrew Scheer and NDP Leader Jagmeet Singh.
Justin Trudeau simply cannot continue to govern this country now that Canadians know what he has done. And that is why I am calling on Mr. Trudeau to do the right thing and to resign.
What we need to do is get to the truth, and that's what a public inquiry will do.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways. On jobs, my job as Prime Minister is to stand up for jobs right across the country, to make sure that we're creating good jobs, that we're growing good growing more jobs, and that we're defending the jobs we already have. My jobs.
This is the Reporter's Notebook on the Breaker.News podcast. Greg Douglas will be recognized at the March 5th Jewish Community Center of Greater Vancouver Sports Dinner for being a fixture on the sports media scene on the West Coast for more than half a century. Douglas wrote for the Vancouver Sun and was the sports director at WX 1130 Radio. He was also the public relations director for the Vancouver Canucks in their early National Hockey League years. Douglas, who is known by the nickname Dr. Sport, will be honored with the 2019 Jack Diamond Sports Personality of the Year Award. I sat down and spoke to him about his career, which began by accident when he was caught with a radio that he smuggled into school so that he could listen to the World Series.
1956, the Yankees and the Dodgers. I think it was Don Larson's no-hitter, if I'm not mistaken. But I was listening to the World Series, and I got caught by the principal. I got caught by the teacher. This is about grade 8. He wheeled me into the principal's office and said, you know, this is what he's been doing, listening to the radio for my whole class. And fortunately, the principal was a baseball fan and had a sense of humor. And he said, well, if that's the case, from now on, every afternoon before school breaks, you're going to bring the whole school up to date with a sportscast. So I was on the PA system throughout Francis H. Clerk School in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, giving a newscast, a sportscast, every Friday afternoon. And I thought, hey, this is kind of neat. And that's what got me interested.
Then you eventually went to Toronto, broke into the industry there, and then found your way to Vancouver.
Well, what happened was I was playing junior hockey in Northern Ontario. I was a goaltender, and there was a guy named Tony Esposito who was the same age as me, and I don't have to tell you that there wasn't room for two goaltenders for the Sioux team when Tony Esposito was doing his thing even back then. So I did get a tryout with the St. Catharines Teepees back in those days, and I knew it wasn't going to work, so I came back home and picked up on the newspaper industry and started writing sports for the local paper, and eventually went down to Toronto to try to hit the big market. And I bounced around with Canadian Press and Broadcast News, which was like working in a factory in those days, but my goal was to get on with the Toronto Star. And I went and banged on Milton Nell's door many, many times. He was a legendary sports columnist, and he liked me, but he didn't have any room for me. And he recommended to his friend, Erwin Swangard, who then was the manager of the Vancouver Sun and who was back in Toronto looking for some fresh blood, as he called it. And Mr. Donnell recommended me. He said, there's this kid knocking on my door that I'd like to hire, but I don't have room for him. So anyway, I met with Mr. Swangard, and he hired me to write. Well, he gave me a choice. He said, you can write hockey or baseball, whichever you want. And I chose baseball because the spring training was coming up. And he said he'd send me to Florida. So I thought, yeah, that's a no-brainer. And the day I was leaving Toronto was the day Milt Donnell phoned and said, I got good news. He said, we got a spot for you. He was going to hire me to do track and field. And I said, I'm getting on a plane later today at your recommendation to go west. And he said, oh, you don't have to do that now. And I said, I have to go, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, I ended up in Vancouver covering the Vancouver Mounties and also the Vancouver Canucks before they became an NHL franchise.
Yeah, and in the Western League. What happened was I was hired to be the baseball writer. The late Jim Taylor, the late great Jim Taylor, who just recently passed, he was going to take out the football beat, and another chap was going to do the hockey, the Western Hockey League. And I did the baseball that summer, and then winter came, and I was destined to be a desk man for the winter. And our hockey writer made his first road trip to Portland, and we never heard from him for weeks on end. So he got removed, and Mr. Swangard called me, and he said, do you think you can handle both, the baseball and the hockey? And I said, absolutely. And that's how that happened. So again, it was like being in the right spot at the right time, you know?
By 1974, the Vancouver Canucks' honeymoon wore off, and fans wanted to see a winner. The team looked for innovative ways to put bums in seats. It was the 1970s, and streaking was the fad.
I have denied, tongue-in-cheek, having had anything to do with it. I'll just explain to you the scene without knowing who was behind it all. There was a well-known after-hours nightclub in Vancouver, still in operation, the Penthouse, and they did feature strippers. And back in the early 70s, streakers were the big thing. Remember, we were seeing them at the New York Islanders games. We saw one at the Philadelphia game. So the Canucks are playing a rare Saturday afternoon on Hockey Night in Canada, which means it's shown nationally from coast to coast. And the three ladies arrived in fur coats, shoulder to floor fur coats. They did have runners on. They weren't totally disrobed. And the deal, as I understand it, was during the play, a stoppage of play. This is very important. During a stoppage of play, they would run out from the New York Islanders tunnel, jog down to the Canucks tunnel, and it would all be done in 40 seconds, and no harm done because there was a commercial on television and it was a stoppage of play. And one of them allegedly got smart and said, if we go out there during a commercial break, nobody's going to see us on TV. Let's go now. Well, now happened to be when Al Arbour's Islanders were pressing in the Vancouver end, and during the game, all of a sudden, out they came. and everything stopped. Of course, the players stopped, the fans gasped, and it was afternoon on hockey night in Canada. And back in Montreal, Mr. Clarence Campbell, the president of the league, was watching the game from his den at home. And he saw it and was shocked. And lo and behold, at the end of the first period, CBC National Television, the then host, intermission host Ted Reynolds, is interviewing the famed Babe Pratt and says, "Babe, the Canucks didn't look very good in that first period, but there were other things that looked pretty good. What would you say was the highlight?" And Babe said, "Without a doubt, play it again, Roger." And up pops the Streakers again on tape in the intermission. And that's when the telex machines started ringing and the phones from Mr. Campbell's office saying, "Stop this madness now." And there was a big league investigation. The league ruled that the Canucks were to destroy all film and steal pictures of it all. And one hangs today in the walls of the penthouse. So it was a lot of fun, but it did get the Canucks into a little bit of trouble. I tried my darndest to investigate it and couldn't come up with any answers. Did you buy that?
A change of management at the Canucks meant Douglas returned to a media career.
After I got fired, I opened my own little PR firm, but I kept my hand in media. And I was working at CKWX for quite a while and became the sports director there. And one year we were challenging CKNW, who were the kings of the sports market, and we were going to hopefully get the BC Lions rights stolen away from them. Didn't happen, and that's another story. But so dabbling or keeping involved in radio led to doing some television, and then returning to the Vancouver Sun, where I wrote a names column. I was going to say gossip, but it wasn't gossip. It was just a sports notes column. That lasted a long time. I went on about 19 years, and it was just a weekly. But I had more fun with that than anything I've ever done, because it was all about people, all about personalities. And I didn't get into, you know, what coach should be fired or what player should be traded. That wasn't the shtick. It was telling stories that the reader could pick up on Saturday mornings and not having heard about prior to reading the column. And that was a challenge, and that was the highlight of my newspaper career, I would say.
What do you think of the way it is today versus the way it was in the 60s when you got here?
I can answer that question with this quick story, Bob. I used to go to BCIT and talk to the broadcast journalism students, young people, and that was in the day where, you know, you didn't have coaches scrums at the end of a game. You chased a story, you chased an item, you tried to beat the guy who was on the other beat, like the Vancouver Sun and Province. When I covered baseball with the Vancouver Sun and Grant Kerr covered it for the Province, we didn't speak to each other until we filed our stories, and then we'd go and have a beer. But now, of course, it's not like that anymore. And everybody, so many newspapers and television and radio now depend on network news, i.e., right now, post-media, you pick up the Sun and you don't have to read the Province. You pick up the Province, you don't have to read the Sun. So it's not the same. And I hate to reflect on that because times change. I have a middle-aged daughter now who, if I say, this is a hot story, pick it up at the newsstand, she'll say, "The what?" You know, because they don't read newspapers anymore. It's all on their iPhones and social media. So that way it's changed, and I'm sad to see it. But I must say, I enjoyed the best of times in the industry because it was action, competitive, and whenever you've got competitiveness, of course, you've got people following you. So that's I enjoyed it, and I kind of feel sorry for the media people now. That like a reporter, a newspaper reporter showing up doing his own camera work and doing a little TV clip. I mean, that just isn't the way it was. But we can't live in the past, and I know that.
That was my interview with Greg Douglas, who remains active in the Vancouver sports media scene as the media relations director at Hastings Racecourse. Greg is the Jack Diamond Sports Personality of the Year award winner for 2019 at the Jewish Community Center of Greater Vancouver's annual sports dinner, March 5th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Special guests are NFL legends Joe Montana and Jerry Rice. Go to jccsportsdinner.com for more information. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Travis Lule, the BC Lions quarterback who led the team to its 2011 Grey Cup championship and was also the CFL's most valuable player that season. The 35-year-old Oregon native from Montana State threw for more than 21,000 yards and 127 touchdowns during his CFL career. He retired after a decade in the orange and black. Thank you, Travis. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 3rd, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on March 3rd in 1875, the first organized ice hockey game indoors at the Victoria Skating Rink in Montreal? Two teams of nine players each chased a wooden puck on a 204-foot by 80-foot rink on Drummond Street. The Montreal Gazette reported that Captain Creighton's team beat Captain Torrance's team 2-1. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.